In America, there are many religions and many gods. Millions of people want to believe in something, so scores of mighty church organizations offer them their services. The old and, if one may say so, the European religions suffer because of a certain abstraction. Let them stay in Europe, on that old and decrepit continent. In America, side by side with skyscrapers, electric washing machines, and other attainments of the age, they somehow pale into insignificance. Los Angeles, in translation, means City of Angels. Yes, it is a city of angels, smeared in oil. Here, as in Oklahoma City, the oil was found in the city itself, and entire streets are occupied by metal derricks. They tap, pump, make money. Los Angeles is a ponderous city, with large buildings, dirty and populous streets, iron fire escapes which stick out the facades of the houses. This is a California Chicago. Brick, slums, the realest kind of poverty, and the most revolting wealth. We circled in our automobile around the restaurant we had selected without finding a place where we could park our car. Looking for a place to park, we drove further and further away from our restaurant, migrating from street to street. But the city was so full of automobiles that we could not find a place for just one more little, respectable, mouse-coloured automobile. We drove to the very end, where even the noises of the city did not reach, and in the darkness, we heard only the roar of the ocean. Here, we finally parked and went to a restaurant. We had to walk a half hour to it. This is what happens occasionally in a country where there are 25 million automobiles. In the restaurant, holding onto a fork of a large piece of pale Christmas turkey, Mr. Adams solemnly exclaimed, "Now, gentlemen, we have come to the very end of the United States. We cannot go any further. From now on, no matter what we do, no matter where we go, we are going home, to New York. We have already driven 6,000 miles. Hurrah!" Tired, we got into our trusty automobile, which again raced off with us. The quiet roar of the motor and the measured roar of the gravel under our fenders lulled us to sleep. We drowsily shook our heads, and even Mr. Adams became thoughtful. But we were awakened from the silence that suddenly overtook us. The machine was standing. We discovered that a hitchhiker was asking us to take him. We took him, and we were sorry at once. He talked like a drunkard. "War is coming," he announced, stuttering uninterruptedly, swallowing phrases and syllables. "The young people want to fight. They've got to have something to do. They need some kind of work. Work and fame. There is no work. The machines have taken it from people. It wouldn't be a bad thing to destroy at least part of those accursed machines." We'd heard this many times by now. To set things right, it was a good thing to kill part of the people in war and to destroy a part of the machines. Then everything will again go smoothly. "Mexicans," said our fellow traveller in his drunken voice, "like to live in dirt. No matter how much money they earn, they will always be dirty. That's the kind of people they are. Give them $5 a week, give them even $5 a day. It will do no good." It was easy for our hitchhiker to live with such views. Everything was easily solved. Part of the people must be killed, part of the machines must be destroyed. And if there are any poor people, it is because they are a special kind of people. They like to live in poverty. All those Mexicans and Poles. The South was approaching. The last mile separating us from Louisiana, we drove through forests. The sun looked out. It was warm and joyous, as in the springtime in the Ukraine. Finally, we passed the little post with the inscription, "State of Louisiana," and raced alongside reddish fields of harvested cotton. The monumental churches of the East and the West were succeeded by wooden, whitewashed little churches on poles instead of foundations. Spanish and Indian names were succeeded by French names. We drove up to a large river. In the twilight, it gleamed like metal. "Mississippi!" exclaimed Mr. Adams.
"This is not the Mississippi," said Mrs. Adams, calmly.
"This is the Mississippi."
"This is not the Mississippi."
"Becky, it depresses me to hear you say that this is not the Mississippi."
"Nevertheless, it is not the Mississippi."
Mr. Adams groaned. "We drove across the bridge and found ourselves in Morgan City. Before going off to look for a night's lodging, we stopped at a restaurant called the Blue Goose to have our dinner."
"Sir?"
asked Mr. Adams of the proprietor, winking an eye. "What is the name of that river?"
"I know what it is, but my wife would like to know."
"This is the Atchafalaya," replied the proprietor.
"Sorry, what?"
"Atchafalaya."
"Oh, thank you. Very, very," muttered Mr. Adams, backing out. "Very, very."
It was only 100 miles to New Orleans. On a sunny morning, we started on our journey. It was soft, almost summery weather. In the course of several hours, we met the monotonous and pathetic bored huts of the black farm workers. Here was the devastating monotony of limitless poverty, a kind of standard of poverty. In the doorless entrances, almost falling apart, one could see not only no cows, pigs, or chickens, but not even a wisp of straw. This was the very lowest stage of poverty, before which the picturesque poverty of the Indians may seem the height of well-being, even of luxury. This was in South United States, in one of the most fruitful places on the globe. Before us again appeared a large, smooth, and completely deserted river, which reminded us of the Volga, although perhaps not so broad. "This is the Mississippi," said Mrs. Adams, triumphantly. Mr. Adams sighed heavily. He would have paid a high price that that river should bear some other name. We were driving into New Orleans. New Orleans might have been called the American Venice. After all, like Venice, it has risen out of water if its innumerable canals had not been hidden underground. In honor of the unseen canal, the main street is called Canal Street. It divides the city into two parts: the French, which is as careless as old Paris, with its little streets, its small arches on thin wooden posts, its stores, its restaurants of unprepossessing appearance with first-class French cooking, its port inns, cobbled streets, and street stands filled with vegetables and fruits, the beauty of which stands out particularly thanks to the proximity of dirt and slops thrown right out into the street, and the new, American part, which adds nothing to the character of the American cities already known to the readers. The further we moved through the southern states, the more frequently we met with all kinds of limitations designed for the black population. Sometimes they were separate comfort stations, or a special bench at an autobus stop, or a special section of the streetcar. Here, even the churches were separate, for example, one for white Baptists and another for the black Baptists. When the Baptist God, several years hence, returns to Earth in order to destroy Soviet atheists who help one another, he will be delighted with his establishments in the South of America. Our further route lay along the Gulf of Mexico, through the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. We met black people with more and more frequency. At times, for several hours at a stretch, we saw no white people. But in the cities, the white man ruled, and if a black person appeared at some moss-covered mansion in the residential part, he would invariably have a broom, a pail, or a package, all of which pointed to the fact that here he could be only a servant. And yet the soul of the South is its people, not its white people, but its black. Speaking now of white people, we have in view these Southern gentlemen, and not them only, but also the gentlemen from the North, who are likewise infected with the psychology of slave owning. We also want to say that not all the people in the South regard black people as lower beings, but to our regret, these are the majority. True to our rule to take into the automobile people waiting for the occasion on the road, at an isolated petrol station in North Carolina, we picked up an 18-year-old boy from a CCC camp near Washington. These camps had been built by President Roosevelt for unemployed young men, originally for 6 months. Roosevelt hoped to end unemployment in 6 months, but Later, when it became clear that it was not so easy to end unemployment, the camps were left for an indefinite period. Quite a cold rain was pouring. His story was ordinary. His father was a farmer. The old man's affairs were not so good. The boy graduated from a high school. He didn't have enough money to go to college. He set out to look for a job. He did not find it. We were passing through a black village. "You can tell a black man's house right away from a white man's house," our fellow traveller said with a smile. We replied, "How does it happen then that all the black people are poor?"
"I don't know about that."
"Is your father acquainted with any black people?"
"We know many."
"And you treat them well?"
"Of course."
"Would you ask such a black person to sit down at the table with your family?"
The youth laughed.
"No, that's impossible."
"But why?"
"Well, because black and white people cannot sit together at the same table."
"But why not?"
"You must be from New York," said the young man. "To the southern mind, New York is the limit of free thinking and radicalism." Not only here, but even in New York itself, about which the young boy from the South talked with such horror, it is almost impossible to see a black person in a restaurant, a motion picture theatre, or a church, unless, of course, he is there as a servant or a porter. By law, black people are free citizens of the United States, yet in the South, under various pretexts, they are deprived of the right to vote. And in Washington itself, and not alone Washington, but in the very building where the laws were written, the following occurred. A black man by the name of DePriest was elected to Congress from the city of Chicago. To the disaffection of the white congressman, he sat beside them at the sessions of the House of Representatives. But that wasn't all. This black man, with his black secretary, went to eat in the congressional dining room. He could not be turned out, and he paid no attention, whatever, to the quiet demonstrations against him. Finally, they thought of an excellent way out of the situation. They closed the dining room. They closed down entirely the congressional dining room, just so that the black man would not be able to eat with the white people. And so, after making 10,000 miles, we found ourselves in the capital of the United States. Washington, with its comparatively low government buildings, its gardens, its monuments, its broad streets, looks somewhat like Vienna, somewhat like Berlin, somewhat like Warsaw, somewhat like all the capitals. And only automobiles remind one that this city is located in America. Here there is an automobile for every two persons, but there is not a single permanent theatre for the entire population of 500,000. Having looked over George Washington's house in Mount Vernon, having visited sessions of Congress, and having been at the grave of the unknown soldier, we discovered that there was nothing else really to see. Only the president remained to be seen. And in America, that is not so difficult. Twice a week, at 10 o'clock in the morning, the president of the United States receives journalists. We managed to come to such a reception. It took place in the White House. Gradually, about 100 people gathered. They smoked, talked aloud, and looked impatiently at the small white door behind which, apparently, the President of the United States was sequestered. Finally, the door opened, and the journalists, crowding each other, rushed ahead. We ran with the rest of them. Before us, in the depths of a circular private study, on the walls of which hung old lithographs depicting Mississippi steamers, and in the small niches of which stood models of frigates, at a medium-sized writing desk, a smoking cigarette in his hand, and Chekhovian pince-nez on his large, handsome nose, sat Franklin D. Roosevelt, President of the United States. Behind his back twinkled the stars and stripes of two national flags. Questions began. The correspondents asked them. The president answered. All of this ritual was, of course, somewhat conditional. Everybody knows that the president will not disclose any particular secrets to the journalists. Certain questions the president answered seriously and quite extensively, parried some with a jest. It is not so easy, of course, twice a week to get off with a joke against 100 pushing journalists. To still others, he replied that he would discuss them next time. Roosevelt's large, handsome face looked tired. Only the day before, the Supreme Court had vetoed the AAA, Roosevelt's law regulating farmers' sowing of crops, one of the pivots of his program. The questions and answers took up to half an hour. There resounded a helter-skelter, "Goodbye, Mr. President," and everybody departed. And Mr. President remained alone in his circular study, among the frigates and the star-spangled banners. Our journey came to an end. Within 2 months, we had been in 25 states and several hundred towns. We had breathed the dry air of deserts and prairies and crossed the Rocky Mountains, had seen Indians, had talked with the young unemployed, with the old capitalists, with radical intellectuals, with revolutionary workers, with poets, with writers, with engineers. We had travelled 10,000 miles, and throughout that entire journey, we never once stopped thinking of the Soviet Union. We had travelled over American highways, but in our thoughts were Soviet highways. We spent nights in American hotels, but we thought about Soviet hotels. We examined Ford's factories, but in our thoughts we saw ourselves in our own automobile factories, and while conversing with Indians, we thought of Kazakhstan. It is necessary to see the capitalist world in order to appreciate, in a new way, the world of socialism. The average American cannot endure abstract conversations, nor does he touch upon themes too far removed from him. He is interested only in what is directly connected with his house, his automobile, or his nearest neighbours. He shows an interest in the life of the country once in every 4 years, at the time of the presidential election. We do not at all insist that this absence of spirituality is an organic attribute of the American people. It is capitalism that has made these people thus, and in every way it nurtures in them this spiritual lassitude. Terrible are the crimes of American capitalism, which with amazing trickiness has palmed off on the people the most trivial of motion pictures, radio, and weekly journalistic tosh, while reserving for itself Tolstoy, Van Gogh, and Einstein, but remaining profoundly indifferent to them. At the foundation of life of the Soviet Union lies the communist idea. We have a definite goal toward which the country advances. America does not know what will happen with it tomorrow. We know, and we can tell with definite accuracy what will happen with us 50 years from now. And we can say honestly, with hand on heart, that we would not like to live in America. It is interesting to observe this country, but one does not care to live in it. In New York, we boarded the steamer. The huge bulk of the Majestic had already left the pier, and we heard for the last time, "Goodbye, gentlemen. Seriously, I hope that you have understood what America is." And over the heads of the people at the pier, frantically waved the trusty old hat of Mr. Adams and the handkerchief of his wife, who twice drove us across the entire continent, the never-tiring, patient, ideal fellow traveller of the road. When the Majestic sailed past Wall Street, darkness fell and lights appeared in the skyscrapers. In those windows gleamed the gold of electricity, but perhaps also real gold. This last golden vision of America escorted us to the very egress into the ocean. The Majestic gathered speed. The farewell light of a boy flashed by, and a few hours later, there was not a trace left of America. The cold January wind blew a large ocean wave.